And now, in conversation with the boyhood heroes who became his broadcasting colleagues, this is My Radio 1 with Sean
Tilley. From its launch in 1967, right through the 70s to the mid-80s, BBC Radio 1 was probably the world's biggest music station. In this series, I'm introducing you to many of the people behind the network's success during those golden years, as they each tell the story of their Radio 1. Sean Tilley.
My Radio 1.
Pat Sharp's here on Radio 1. Yes, we've been talking for an hour and a quarter now, and I already feel I know you. We've got a new voice and an old record. It's the best way to do it, isn't it? From 1967, a Eurovision winner, Sandy Shaw, and a puppet on a string, one of my favourites.
Well, based on that clip, this old pal of mine hardly needs any introduction, but it's only right and proper that I do the honours anyway. Hello, Pat Sharp.
Hello, Sean Tilley.
So, roughly, how old were you when you started getting into music and listening avidly to the radio?
I would think I was probably around about 13 or 14. I was buying records on 7-inch single, not really albums, but certainly singles. And on top of the singles that I was buying, I was listening to the radio, and I had a cassette radio that was really cool. I think it was a Sharp, which I really liked because I felt it was personalised. And it had a button on it. Well, certainly a knob anyway, that you could turn. And when you turned this knob, it actually got rid of the sound of the music on the radio, and you could speak into the mics that were built into the cassette radio.
That's quite high-tech for the time, isn't it?
It was. So I was doing my own intros and then guessing when the vocal was coming and then turning the vocal back up in the hope that the DJ wasn't going to speak over it as well. But I was certainly, that was my first sort of inkling of radio.
When it started for you as a DJ, as a profession, it was with the mobile discos.
Yep, I had a disco that was called Gary and Paddy's Hit Connection, but we spelled connection C-O-N-N-E-X. I-O-N. Yeah, that was my mobile disco, and I bought Gary out, so it just became, I got rid of the Paddy thing, because I thought, Paddy, Patrick, no, none of those are going to work. Let's make it something shorter and sharper. So I went for Pat Sharp's Hit Connection, and that's where I chose that name, because my actual surname is Sharpin.
Radio 1 is fun. It's the station that's alive. We're on 275 and 285.
So you're rise to become a celebrated Radio 1 DJ at the age of 20 was, I guess, a little like winning the lottery, really, wasn't it? You and I have known each other for a long time. I know the story, but for anybody who doesn't know, right from the beginning, how did it happen?
Well, yes, we have known each other a long time, and it was a long time ago when this happened. I was 20 years of age, and in 1982, a record plugger came to one of my mobile discos, and somebody there, it was a wedding of some kind, and somebody there knew the record plugger and said to me afterwards that he thought you were very good as a DJ and said he might be able to get you connected to radio in some kind. And I thought, well, that'd be good. I'm not quite sure what a record plugger is, but I found out eventually that he was the guy who obviously, you know, took records into radio stations and got them to try and play them. So he took my home number, I guess, where I lived with my parents, and tried to get me into radio, but didn't really have any luck because I didn't get into radio. But about 3 months of trying after I first met him, he put me in touch with a manager. And this manager looked after the likes of Simon Bates and Mike Reed and DLT and Annie Nightingale and Paul Gambaccini and many of the big Radio 1 DJs. And he eventually was going to sign one new person who hadn't got any experience. And it was between me and another DJ who was Paul McKenna. And Paul wasn't into hypnotism at the time and couldn't convince this manager to drop his commission. So because his commission didn't drop, and it was 25% at the time, Paul said, well, I'm not going to go with you. So Michael took me, because I said, I'll pay 25%.
This is Michael Cohen we're talking about.
Yeah, this is Michael Cohen, who was looking after many of the DJs, as I say. So I thought, well, I'm happy to pay 25% of nothing, because I have nothing. I'm just, you know, doing mobile discos. And That was probably in April, I should think, of 1982. And in September 1982, I sat in for Steve Wright on Radio 1.
Yeah, but it didn't just happen like that. Tell me about Michael's office ringing you and saying you need to come in because there's somebody here who's dying to meet you.
Well, I don't know if she was dying to meet me, but he did phone and say, I've got somebody who wants to meet you. Come up to my office straight away. And I met a lady called Doreen Davis, who was the second in command at Radio 1 and was standing quite regally in Michael's office in Wardour Street in the midst of all the sex shops, because that was what Soho was like then. And she was very smart and had a big sort of medallion-type necklace on or something. And I thought to myself, wow, who is this lady? And he said, well, this is Doreen. She's one of the big bosses at Radio 1, and she wants you to sit in and cover Steve Wright in the afternoon for a week. And that will be in 3 or 4 weeks' time. And I went, okay, that's...
So you've not even got time to process this, really?
Yeah, absolutely, Sean. And I hadn't even been really, to be honest with you, I hadn't even done a hospital radio show at that stage. I'd been to my local hospital radio station. I'd tried to get a show. I never got one because I was upset with them because my bicycle got stolen outside, so I never went back. I was gutted because I thought, I'm not going to walk all the way up there now.
It's a shame your bicycle wasn't nicked outside Radio 1, because there was a lot of press mileage with that. Absolutely. That would have been a good story, wouldn't it?
It would have been a good story after I left, because the headline would have been on your bike show.
Well, we haven't got to that yet. Tell me
about... it's not far away.
No, come on, I'm not having that. There's some good stuff to talk about between now and then. Tell me about your first official visit to Radio 1, knowing that you're going to be doing, let's face it, one of the biggest shows on British radio. At that time, it still is. Can anything prepare you for that?
The funny thing about it is that even though it was an amazing thing to be doing and I was really excited about it, it wasn't what I actually wanted to do, because I lived in London and I wanted to be on Capital, and I listened to Capital and didn't know very much about Radio 1. And there were a bunch of guys who were on Radio Luxembourg who I also looked up to, as well as the Radio 1 or Capital DJs and people I was listening to at the time, who were probably thinking, why is he going in there and not me?
Toto Coelho from the charts and I Eat Cannibals. Good afternoon to you. This is National Radio 1 on 275 metres and 285 on the medium wave. My name's Pat Sharp, as you've probably guessed by now, because DLT's been chatting about me for the last few minutes. None of it's true. How are you? Nice to talk to you on a Monday afternoon for Steve Wright between 2 and 4.30. This is Kim Carnes. Her new single is called Voya.
The household names, when you walked in, the likes of Mike Reed, Simon Bates, Steve Wright himself, of course, who would have been on air for those couple of weeks before you depth for him. The lovely Peter Powell. I could go on and on and on and on. Did you get a lot of encouragement?
Yes, I did. They were nothing but nice. I just remember being more in awe and wanting to really, I suppose, in a way...
get their autographs.
Yeah, or get a selfie. Not that there was such a thing, but... No, I remember going there for the first time and meeting my producer. And also, on the first day I went there, I met Mike Smith there. And I thought, that's a bit odd.
Tim Blackmore, Tony Hale, Roy Jones, David Briggs and Stephen Robin, who've all been involved over the past couple of years producing The Breakfast Show, they put it together. For every person you hear on air at Capital, there's at least 10 others who you never hear of at all, and they're the important ones, so thank you to the engineers and everybody like that. Listen, all I can say to you is not bye-bye, but till we meet again, all right?
He does breakfast on Capital.
Yes, he hadn't officially signed then.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Mm. You've never told me that before.
No, Mike Smith was there on my first day as well, and I remember thinking, oh, that's so exciting. I love Mike Smith. I love Capital Breakfast. I felt like saying, what are you doing here, Mike? Did you take a wrong turn? Then I realised, oh, he must be here for a job.
Be a safe driver.
And up to news with Grand Master Flash and the Furious Five and the message. It's Pat Sharp for Steve Wright. That's the message. New DJ on Radio 1. Thanks for your company. Nice to be here. Good afternoon. The news is next.
Did you get much time to practice before that first show? Going into the Continuity Studios for the very first time? Of course, the faders would have worked the other way.
Yep, faders worked the other way. They went from, instead of pushing them up, you pulled them towards you, and they were sort of like, if you take your fingers and your hand and you bend them slightly, they went like
yeah,
that.
Like arched fade.
Yeah, they were like arch faders, like going over sort of a humpback bridge. And I didn't get a lot of practice, but I know I did get practice, and it was so much fun practicing. And even from my first practicing, I was taking out carts and slamming things over intros of records. And I remember my producer saying, all right, there's no need to be too ambitious.
That's Dave Price you're talking about.
Yeah, lovely man, late Dave Price.
He was very encouraging to you.
He was amazing to me. And one thing that Dave Price did, I don't know if anybody else has ever mentioned this on this series, but it's really good, is I used to sit with him and decide what records we were going to play, you know, on those five shows that I had to make some kind of impact. And one of the reasons why he did this was because he told me that it was very important to hear songs as the listener would hear them on AM, because Radio 1 was on 275 and 285, no FM. So he had a switch that connected the record player in his office that he turned, and then the music, instead of coming out of speakers, came out of a radio that sounded a bit like this. So it was sounding AM instead of FM. And that's how he would hear the records. And that meant that genuinely he could think, that's how it will sound on the radio, so I will determine whether it gets played or not like that. And that was I found that very interesting at the time. And I remember the record plugger guy who went on to be very famous, working with Elton John and George Michael, a guy called Gary Farrow, and Sony Music, and a big boss in the record industry. Gary was obviously plugging me like mad, because he was the guy who'd given me my break and got me connected with Michael Cohen and saw me at the wedding, and he was the first guy who ever took an interest in my so-called skills. And Gary was plugging me like mad. He goes, "Here, give this to Dave Price. You got to get this on. Play this four times an hour." And I always remember the name of the record he was plugging at that time in September 1982 when I did those shows. And it was a band called Sava Sava. And the song was called Where's Romeo, which no one will have heard of, but I played it literally every day because I felt like I owed Gary. I remember Dave Price said to me, "So what do you want to play in this section of the show here?" And I went, "Oh, I've got a great new record here, Savas Savar, Where's Romeo?" He goes, "Is that Farrow record again?" He sussed it straight away.
Peter Powell at 4:30, including at 5 o'clock a couple of rounds of the record race, and at 6:05, stepping out, the latest on the dance music scene.
And thanks, Pat Sharp, as well, for a debut for Radio 1. Excellent, mate, well done. He looks like he's just come straight from the surfing beaches of California. Radio 1's newest beach boy.
It was then 3 months before you were given a regular Radio 1 slot. What were you doing in that time? Waiting for the phone to ring, I guess.
Well, I did move stations in that time. I decided that working on one national station wasn't enough at my age with no experience.
Now, you were showing off at this stage.
No, I was just double lucky, Sean. I got a phone call from Tony Prince, who said, "Come and do some shows at Radio Luxembourg." And he didn't phone me, he phoned my manager and said, "You know, we'll have this Radio 1 reject." It was on for a week and then disappeared and went back to washing his car. So, yeah, let's take him. So I went off to Luxembourg and did 2 weeks on Luxembourg in November, during which time I got another call from my manager who said, "Guess what? You're coming back to England because you're going to join Radio 1 with two other new DJs starting in December with Gary Davis and Janice Long."
This is Radio Luxembourg, 208 metres, 1440 kilohertz medium wave. Now also on 3FM frequencies in Europe and around the world on 49.26 metres shortwave. Wherever you are, Radio Luxembourg is right there with you.
I wasn't over keen on living in Luxembourg. I didn't really like it. I felt a long way from home, and I was only young, and you know, my family and my girlfriend, they obviously weren't there, and I just felt very lonely, because even though I was on the air for 2 hours in the day and 3 hours at night, because you'll know, having worked at Luxembourg, they have like a community station during the day, it wasn't enough for me. I would have been on air 20 hours a day and kept myself busy, but the rest of the time I just stood in the park a bit bored going, "Wow, it's
not
cold
a good
here.
Idea to stay in that park for too long."
Yeah,
to
I heard about
particularly
that,
particularly with your looks.
Oh, thank you, darling. I did get flashed a couple of times.
So all of a sudden you're hurtling back to London, and you're officially signed up to Radio 1, and then Top of the Pops comes, first one you ever did with Peter Powell. What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember that it was a Top of the Pops where they had us all on to introduce the new Radio 1 DJ.
So with your shiny jackets as well, with your name on.
The jacket that I threw away.
You realise saying that on this series, people are going to be cursing the radio right now.
I know. I think,
well liked as you are, people are just not going to be able to accept that.
I agree. And do you know what? I'm so cheesed off that I threw that jacket away.
Hi, I'm Pat Sharp.
Oh, if you're... he's a good-looking boy.
Mm. If you're around tomorrow morning between 6 and 8,
what
then
time
I'll...
did you say? 6 o'clock?
Yeah, that's right. If you don't like to waste a minute of the day, I'll be on the radio helping you to feel good on a Sunday morning.
Mm, what are you going to be doing to me then?
Well, I've got some great music for you and a few bits of fun and games to help you start the day right.
Yeah, I hope you're not going to do any of them early morning exercises.
No, to start your day.
Sunday the 5th of December, 1982, 6 a.m. First official Pat Sharp programme. Produced by John Sparrow.
Yes, John Sparrow. Yeah, with his goatee beard. And hopefully he's still around. He was a very nice man, actually. And I remember, because of my love of jingles, he used to say to me after my show, not the first one, but after about four or five shows, seems to be playing a lot of jingles. You know, I don't think he ever heard the show live, but he certainly listened back to it and said, why do you play a jingle between every record? I said, well, the records are getting in the way, to be honest with you.
Been coming on a Sunday morning after a whole barrage of jingles which kicked off the network.
They used to have these this jingle package, this montage of literally every Radio 1 jingle in the package and this music, which was meant to wake up the network, because of course it wasn't 24 hours Radio 1 in those days. So there was this sort of selection of jingles, and then I would start with probably more than that. That lasted 5 minutes. My intro to my show was about 7.
Number one for music.
Hi, it's 6 o'clock sharp.
Pat Sharp, Radio 1. You'll always hear a song.
And you were handing over to a Radio 1 icon, yeah. Tony Blackburn. Yeah. That must have been something special. I mean, because obviously we both know Tony very well. Lovely guy, and I can imagine even back in those days, really encouraging to you.
Absolutely, and he was. And Tony always... in those days, worked with Maggie on a Saturday and Keith on a Sunday, and I would always finish the show by going, "And it's time now to hand over to Tony at 8 o'clock." And he would go, "Is that me or is that you?" And we used to have a bit of banter. And I think he used to, because he was Tony Blackburn and had an awful lot of experience compared to me. I remember one weekend he said, "Pat, what's the difference between a good joke and a bad joke?" And I went, "What?" And as I said that, he went, "Timing."
Hi, good evening. Tremendous solo success for the Fun Boy 3. In 1982, and also for Sarah, Siobhan and Karen, and they got together in February to produce this single, and it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it.
We talked about that first Top of the Pops appearance when you were there with Gary and Janice alongside Peter Bell. Eventually, one of the spin-offs, of course, being a Radio 1 DJ, is that you became a regular host of the show. Very different, I would imagine, when you're turning up to TV Centre, knowing that it's just you and one other person doing it.
Absolutely, yes, that was different because I was the co-host. I only did it probably 3 or 4 times, I think, because I wasn't on my Sunday morning early show slot for very long. I think I did it for 9 months, so 3 contracts of 3 months each, which was fine. They were trying out new people, and I got replaced by Mark Page, and then I think he got replaced by someone else, and vice versa. So it's all good, and if I look back at it, when it's been rerun on BBC Four, I do think I look rather awkward.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I'm kind of like, I used to think, well, that camera's not going to get me in. I better give him a hand. I mean, he's at a funny angle there, trying to be clever. So let me just stand up a bit over here so I can get in. And I think,
did you get any pointers from anybody?
No, nobody told you.
No
what
help
to do.
Whatsoever.
No, you used to just rehearse and work out your clever lines and what you were going to say, which weren't very clever. I just gave it my best shot, and it was an amazing experience. Doing Top of the Pops was a real buzz because, you know, the next morning people looked at you like you were a freak because they go, "It's you. I saw you. Everybody saw."
Back on the music front, the Stranglers had 2 great hit singles this year. One was called Strange Little Girl, the other, Live Golden Brown.
I would imagine it would help in terms of getting booked for more personal appearances.
It did. I ended up doing loads of Radio 1 gigs. I packed my jacket before I threw it away. And off I would go on a train or in my car to places. And people would be, they would come in their thousands. I've got a great picture of me, not me, but certainly my name on the pier at Bournemouth in the summer season, you know, playing gigs with the likes of Noel Edmonds and Simon Bates and Peter Powell and all those DJs. And it's got my name up there. And I played on Bournemouth Pier when I was 20 or 21. I suppose I turned 21 by then, yeah.
It's 1 o'clock, and now Noel Edmonds presents Across the Ether, part one of the story of pop radio.
Was there any regular feedback from the management, senior producers, anything like that? Or were you just more or less left to get on with it?
I don't think that my Sunday show ever set the world on fire. I think probably they didn't keep me because the one thing I didn't have that I did need for that job was experience. And they were right. I was 20 years old. I mean, I do remember that one strange thing, talking of experience, that they sent me out to do when I did that show was they used to send me every week on a different task. And I would then talk about that task on the show. And they said, you've got to be more worldly. You haven't done anything. You haven't been anywhere.
Who would be saying this to you?
I guess it was the management stroke producer, and they decided it was going to be a feature in the show. But it was an ironic feature because it wasn't recorded or played out in the show as audio. I just physically went and did something each week during the week that I could then report on as a participant in my show on the Sunday. So one week I remember going over to the hotel next to Radio 1, and I would go and report in. They were expecting me, and I would wash dishes after breakfast. And I remember they didn't even give me any gloves. And then on the Sunday show, I would tell people what it was like to wash dishes in a hotel, you know, and then, of course, it all came crashing down because I didn't have the experience. I needed to do something else.
So when it did come to an end, how did you find out?
I'm pretty sure it was Derek Chinnery, the boss, yes.
Hello there, I'm just testing the Pat Sharp circuit for this Sunday morning. We'll begin, as always, fairly quietly in first gear at 6 o'clock and work our way up to overdrive at 8, racing with the Fox and the Hound. So, it's one continuous green light for 2 hours of music and chat to drive you wild. Please join us for the fastest moving show around. I'll see you Sunday morning at 6 o'clock.
John Sparrow, I remember his words actually. He goes, yes, could you pop upstairs and see our illustrious leader?
Is that what he said?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure those were his words. So I popped upstairs and came out thinking, well, that wasn't a great day. And, you know, I think I was probably crying, a bit like I cried when I lost my job at Capital. But, you know, now I don't cry at anything because I'm just kind of cool with it. So.
Lock into Hatch. Hot. Rocket.
Summertime in London.
What a beautiful day.
London. Great music for a great city.
Sharp in summertime. Way to go.
London. London's weather.
Morning.
Capital
FM. It is dry, it is sunny, it is warm. Oh, yes, the odd high hazy cloud, but otherwise clear blue skies. Glorious bank holiday sunshine for the city all day long. Staying dry but cold again tonight with clear starry skies. A star could be you if you're a ZZ Top winner. The high 65, dark around 840, air quality good around the world. Florence and Moscow all sunny and London great.
Capital FM.
56.
3 from 1 on Capital FM.
Nice and warm. And Genesis are our 3 from 1. Turning it on again. Let's go.
But you know what? You've had a fantastic career.
Yeah, and also better to have done it than not to have done it. And what a way to start. Absolutely. As I say. It was just, you know, to be on Radio 1. I mean, it's a distant memory, but obviously for me it was just, wow. I mean, how many people get to do that? Not many.
So as you say, it's only about a year or so to look back on, but still, you know, it's a year at Radio 1. What are the most standout memories for you of being with the network?
I had a fantastic time during my first week just being on air for Steve Wright, covering the shows. And I do remember on my very first show, it went round to the first news bulletin. I was trying to get it on time. And I think this is when Radio 1 did their news on the half hour. And obviously there were loads of carts in the studio. I was in a studio which Radio 1 did share with Radio 2 because there were different shows at different times. Radio 1 wasn't on 24 hours a day and some were simulcast and so on and so forth. So I reached around and grabbed a jingle that said news and thought I'd press it in the slot. And I said, it's exactly 2:30, stay sharp. And I hit the button. It went, Radio 2. I remember my producer, Dave, he just looked in through the window and went, well, you've certainly moved up the networks quickly. Half an hour at Radio 1 and you've made it to Radio 2.
But you got it right the next hour.
I did, but it's the only time I've ever got to play a Radio 2 news jingle.
Give it time, son, give it time. Any other memories?
Well, on the other side of things, from hosting Top of the Pops, I remember doing the 1,000th edition as a co-host. But I wasn't a co-host with one other person or even two. I was a co-host with every single Radio 1 DJ who were all put in the same dressing room at TV Centre to get ready. And the egos and the insults flying around that room were amazing. I literally stood there in my M&S underwear looking in awe, wanting to get a photograph or an autograph with all these guys, and they were all going, oh, love, I've got better ratings than you have. Oh, forget it, love, I'm better than you. Oh, hello, dear. You know, and it was all like that. And I was just thinking, looking around, thinking, wow, these guys are all legends. And I'm standing there just in my underwear.
But you were consoled with the fact that they were wearing M&S underwear as well.
Well, of course, I did check that. That was compulsory for being on the 1,000th edition.
Welcome, Vuxviz. Can I ask you, Jay, when you were younger, you used to sit at home, watch Top of the Pops. Did you ever think that you'd appear on it?
No, never in a thousand years.
Great stuff. Well, thank you all for coming. Mike?
And isn't that a lovely string vest that she's wearing this evening? That's a really nice
smooth.
One, isn't
very
it?
Very smooth.
Okay,
very
here come the top ten.
Pat Shop, thank you, as ever, for coming in. But this time around, a little bit different because you were sharing with us your Radio 1. Bless you, sir.
Thank you, Sean.